Others say that Bacon wrote everything that has since been attributed to Shakespeare. By varying accounts, he was the bastard son of Elizabeth I, a precursor of the military-industrial complex, and perhaps the greatest prose stylist that the English language has ever known. I don't think any of this is true. But the fact that it's plausible, and in some instances maybe even partly true, speaks volumes about Francis Bacon's genius. In tonight's program, four of the foremost Baconians in the world will discuss the life and work of the brilliant early 17th century British statesman, philosopher, scientist, and spy, who maybe more than any other Elizabethan Englishman earned the epithet Renaissance Man, Francis Bacon.
My name's Julian Martin. I'm professor of history at the University of Alberta, and I'm a specialist in the 16th and 17th century history of the sciences and medicine, and I am also the editor of several of the volumes of the new Oxford Complete Works of Francis Bacon. He was born to a family of elite crown servants. His father, Sir Nicholas Bacon, was Queen Elizabeth I's Lord Keeper. His uncle was William Cecil, the Queen's Lord Treasurer. He also had three other uncles, one of whom, Thomas Gresham, was the Queen's financier, and two others, Sir Thomas Hoby and Sir Henry Killigrew, were ambassadors for the Queen, an extremely tightly knit kin group, all of whom were dedicated to royal public service. Young Francis Bacon grew up around these men and grew up imbued with the values of public service that they instilled in him. It's very difficult to think of a young boy like Francis having any other intellectual and emotional context in which to read and understand the things he read in school than the one impressed upon him by his dad, which was precisely about royal service.
I'm Alan Stewart. I'm co-authored Hostage to Fortune, The Troubled Life of Francis Bacon with Lisa Jardine, and I'm editor of a new edition of Bacon's correspondence. Although he was the son of the Lord Keeper, he was the fifth son, which is never the best thing to be, the fifth son from the second marriage. So by the time Nicholas Bacon died in 1579, although he'd managed to set up all the first four sons, Francis was left high and dry. So he was at that point 17, 18 years old. So although he came from this incredibly prestigious background, very public background, he was also without means suddenly at that age. So unlike his elder brothers who had all been settled on large estates in the country, he actually had to make a way for himself in society. And I think it's that contradiction in his life of high hopes and very little to sustain it that actually is the key to Bacon right through his career.
Lisa Jardine, Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London, author of Francis Bacon, Discovery and the Art of Discourse, and co-author with Alan Stewart of Hostage to Fortune, general editor of the complete Oxford Francis Bacon. There's a kind of paradox around Francis Bacon, and I don't think we'd have a Francis Bacon if he had been properly set up by his father financially. As Francis Bacon himself says, had he not been pressed by money problems, he would probably have retired to a life of leisured, aristocratic indolence. He says he would have written great works, but actually one asks oneself whether those are the conditions under which great works are written. Instead, he found himself in the hurly-burly of a lawyer's life and then political employment of a kind that was absolutely necessary to sustain his lifestyle. And under those circumstances, he worked on the intellectual issues in that kind of pressured environment, which some of us believe is the most creative for real intellectual achievement.
Studies serve for delight, for ornament, and for ability. The chief use for delight is in privateness and retiring. For ornament is in discourse, and for ability is in the judgment and disposition of business. For expert men can execute and perhaps judge of particulars one by one. But the general counsels and the plots and the marshalling of affairs come best from those that are learned. To spend too much time in studies is sloth. To use them too much for ornament is affectation. To make judgment wholly by their rules is the humor of a scholar. Studies perfect nature, and are perfected by experience. For natural abilities are like natural plants that need pruning by study. And studies themselves do give forth directions too much at large, except they be bounded in by experience. Crafty men condemn studies. Simple men admire them. And wise men use them. Read not to contradict and confute, nor to believe and take for granted, nor to find talk and discourse, but to weigh and consider. Some books are to be tasted, others to be swallowed, and some few to be chewed and digested.
I'm Stephen Gorkroger. I'm Professor of History of Philosophy and History of Science at the University of Sydney, Australia. And I recently completed a book called Francis Bacon and the Transformation of Early Modern Philosophy. In 16th century England and Elizabethan England particularly, there was a great stress on the practical value of various cognitive enterprises. There was a great stress on practical consequences of things. And Bacon's very much in this culture. And he does have this rather startling view that truth, if it's to be truth, has to be productive. It has to produce new works, so to speak. There are no purely contemplative truths. Truth has to show its mettle, so to speak, in practical works. Now, what exactly is going on here is very complicated, I think, but one ingredient might be this, that traditionally, philosophers had been seen primarily as moral philosophers. They'd been seen in terms of the kind of moral sage, the wise man who knows what's good and behaves well as a result. And in discussions over moral theory in the Renaissance of the 16th and early 17th century, there's a lot of attention paid to the fact that someone who knows what's good should behave well. And one of the criticisms that's constantly made of philosophers is that they explore the nature of goodness, but they don't make people better. So there was a famous dispute over the relative merits of poetry and philosophy, and it was argued by the defenders of poetry that poetry made people better, it made people behave better, it made people more moral, whereas philosophy is barren because all it does is it explores the nature of morality but doesn't actually make people better. So there was a push amongst Bacon and others to kind of bring out the practical side of philosophy.
My great desire is to draw the sciences out of their hiding places into the light. For indeed, to write at leisure that which is to be read at leisure matters little. But to bring about the better ordering of man's life and business, with all its troubles and difficulties, by the help of sound and true contemplations, this is the thing that I am at. How great an enterprise in this kind I am attempting, and with what small helps, you will learn perhaps hereafter. In the meantime, you would do me a very great pleasure if you would, in like manner, make known to me what you are yourself revolving and endeavouring and working at. For I hold that conjunction of minds and studies has a greater part in friendships than civil ties and offices of occasion. Surely I think no man could ever more truly say of himself with the psalm than I can. My soul hath been a stranger in her pilgrimage.
Bacon is odd. Bacon has quite a large correspondence. If you look at the correspondence of natural philosophers around the same time, particularly the famous ones, Galileo, Descartes, Mersenne, Bacon, they're either in a patronage system, so their queries and answers go through some central figure, or they have a huge correspondence And you can find them discussing, for example, in the case of Descartes, 20 or 30 problems a day at one point in his life. They are constantly kept up to date on scientific developments through this complicated network of correspondence. Bacon's letters contain no correspondence whatsoever on scientific matters. He just doesn't seem to have any interest in what other natural philosophers are doing. It's as if he's aloof from that. People certainly read Bacon, but they don't have any contact with him, whereas they do tend to have contact with one another. In that respect, Bacon's a very isolated figure. So Bacon's peculiar. He's not like other natural philosophers of the time. He's very isolated, and it's as if he's kind of chosen this isolation, and he's chosen to move in political circles and court circles rather than in the circles of natural philosophers.
Surely part of the problem with Francis Bacon is that he wore so many hats. Politician, poet, pioneer of science. And it's actually not very easy to hold him in any one role long enough to analyze his achievement in any of his many areas of endeavor. In fact, it's probably impossible and maybe even counterproductive, since Bacon's various vocations were fully integrated within his own multifaceted life. There's really no point in trying to separate the scientist from the statesman. They were one and the same Renaissance man from the very beginning. At the age of 14, Francis Bacon's father arranged for the boy to serve an apprenticeship on a 3-year-long diplomatic mission into France. The assignment served a double purpose, simultaneously giving Francis the traditional grand tour of Europe, while removing the son, at least temporarily, from the paternal payroll. Ambassadors were expected to pick up all the expenses. And Francis Bacon started wearing at least 2 more hats. He was now a diplomat of sorts, and he was also, certainly, a spy.
Francis Bacon's first and only trip abroad was in 1576 to 1579 in the entourage of the English ambassador to Paris. And that was an official embassy. The intelligence coming back was allegedly official. But any ambassador worth his salt also had to have intelligences located all over the place who were not official. And so it gets very mixed. Francis took advantage of that opportunity to learn how to cipher, because ciphering was obviously a very basic tool of the intelligencer, just so that information could be obscured for a few hours if need be. It could be dangerous. There are plenty of accounts of messengers having their clothes torn open because they would hide the papers in their collars and their sleeves. And the whole system is incredibly unstable. There were letters going astray constantly. Information went astray. And so it is a very edgy sort of existence, I think.
Intelligence, what's called intelligence, you know, what we'd call spying, we use the term intelligence, as do other people working in this period, because it conveniently reminds us that in the absence of the telephone, let alone the personal computer, the obsession was with knowledge gathering per se. Knowledge gathering of all kinds. What was the prince in some court wearing? What was the latest fashion? What books were they reading? What were they talking to one another about? What was the ground plan of the castle? What was the street plan of the city? Then, which dissident Protestant was communicating with which minor head of state? What were the plans being laid for actual engagements of war? And then, you know, what were the plans for attack on a particular location? Everything, it ran the gamut, literally, from what's Lady T eating for breakfast through who's reading the latest thing by Beza to are they going to attack us and in the near future, and if so, what is the size of their force?
Have to deal with their neighbors, their wives, their children, their prelates or clergy, their nobles, their merchants, their commons, and their men of war, and from all these arise dangers if care and circumspection be not used. First, for their neighbors. There can no general rule be given, the occasions are so variable, save one, which is that princes do keep due sentinel that none of their neighbors do overgrow so by increase of territory, by embracing of trade, or the like, as they become more able to annoy them than they were. For their nobles, to keep them at a distance, it is not amiss, but to depress them may make a king more absolute but less safe. For their merchants, if they flourish not, a kingdom may have good limbs, but will have empty veins and nourish little. For the commons, there is little danger from them, except it be where you meddle with the point of religion or their customs or means of life. For their men of war, it is a dangerous state where they live and remain in a body. Princes are like to heavenly bodies, which have much veneration, but no rest.
As in any period, intelligence gathering is addictive. It's a habit of mind, and it's one that France has certainly got. I don't think we're any different today. I think that buzz that you get from a piece of information nobody else has, putting it together with another piece in a jigsaw so that you see the full picture, that was what they were driven by. There is a sense in which we misunderstand them if we think of it as being paid for. They didn't get money for their information gathering. They got status. They got position in a household. They got a credit rating because they could pass a piece of the Earl of Essex's paper or even the Queen's paper to somebody to settle a hotel bill. And that, it's a very intriguing lifestyle because it encourages self-delusion. And that's something that stayed with Bacon. It encourages you to believe you're more important than you are, because you're a catalyst. It encourages you to a standard of living you can't actually afford. You're not quite paying for it, but neither are you in debt for it. You're riding on somebody else's coattails. When people talk about Bacon, Bacon attracts a kind of audience that is fascinated by his self-grandeur, his self-publicizing, his theatricality. And I think that comes out very early from the lifestyle, which is not supported by a proper position, grand house, or visible expenditure, but is concocted out of all kinds of dreams and fantasies in the way that intelligence / spying encourages.
The buzz you get from a piece of information possessed by nobody else and putting it together with other pieces of the jigsaw so that you ultimately begin to see the whole picture. It sounds suspiciously like Baconian science to me. Some scientists both gather and guard intelligence with the sinister secrecy of the CIA, but Francis Bacon was about to make a career change. A watershed that was marked with a miniature portrait commissioned from the famous society painter, Nicholas Hilliard. On the back, Hilliard inscribed a simple Latin message. Si tabula deretur digna, animum malum aetatis suae. If the face is painted as deemed worthy, I'd prefer to paint his mind. Shortly thereafter, Francis Bacon took lodgings at the Inns of Court to prepare for a legal career and to learn interesting new ways of gathering information.
He was a lawyer, and in the Renaissance, in 16th or the 17th century England, law, history, philology were the models for knowledge, and particularly law was the model for knowledge generally. It was the area in which examples were taken. It is an area that had been extensively systematized. Bacon's first thought seemed to have been in the law, to reorganize the law, to put it on a more systematic footing, to establish sources, clear sources of authority in the law. And I think a great deal of his organizational thought in natural philosophy, which is amongst the most original aspect of Bacon's work, is based on the reforms that he had in mind for law. Now, there's no direct translation between one and the other, and it's complicated by the fact that philosophers are not lawyers. Lawyers are practical people who have been trained in gathering and using particular kinds of evidence and making judgments on the basis of that evidence. One of the problems, as Bacon saw it, was that philosophers generally were a kind of hodgepodge, ranging from alchemists on the one hand, who kind of sat in their labs and caused things to explode, to scholastic philosophers who never went anywhere near a lab, just worked on commentaries on Aristotle or other classical authors. And if you like, what Bacon wanted to do was to kind of regiment philosophers in the way that lawyers had been regimented, into instill the kind of discipline into philosophy, or into natural philosophy, that had been instilled into law. And I think this is a crucial aspect of his program, that what he wants to do is to reshape philosophers. And I think probably the most important model he has in mind is that of lawyers. He wants to make philosophers practical in the way that lawyers are practical, and he wants natural philosophy to contribute to the public good in a way that he thinks law, or at least a suitably reformulated law, contributes to the public good.
His study of the law gives him a sense of regularities that derive from observed experience, information gathering. The English common law, which was the area that Bacon found himself practicing in, is precedent law. So that the regularity that becomes the encoded law is based explicitly on the accumulation of examples that you've gathered, like information gathering, over time. So you move from information gathering in a haphazard way through the code of law, which is the systematic organization of gathered examples from previous law cases, into the scientific investigations that Bacon is engaged in. And that looks to me to be a pretty smooth progress, and one that we ought to pay more attention to, because it'll tell us an awful lot about scientific method that doesn't yield to what I regard as these rather boring 19th century and post-19th century ideas of inductive method and whatnot. That all looks pretty arid and dry to me now. I think that Baconian science comes out of a much more hands-on practice.
Gray's Inn, January 1592. My dearest Uncle Lord Burleigh, I write again to plea for your patronage. The promotion that I so deserve at the Inns of Court eludes me still. I wax now somewhat ancient, 31 years is a great deal of sand in the hourglass, and I confess that I have as vast contemplative ends as I have moderate civil means, for I have taken all knowledge to be my province, and if I could purge it of two sorts of rovers, whereof the one with frivolous disputations, computations, and verbosities, the other with blind experiments and auricular traditions and impostures, has committed so many spoils, I hope I should bring in industrious observations, grounded conclusions, and profitable inventions and discoveries. The best state of my province.
I've taken all knowledge to be my province is a very stirring phrase, and it does sound rather pompous, doesn't it? I mean, certainly the way we today regard a phrase like that, it is a metaphor for something very grand. I think, however, that we must put ourselves back into the early 1590s, when Francis Bacon first wrote to his uncle and included that famous sentence in his letter. Province is, of course, an administrative unit, and that is precisely the way Francis Bacon meant it. I have taken all knowledge to be my area of governance, is perhaps the way to gloss it. And rather than saying something pompous about his own range of intellect. He is saying something rather more pointed about the relationship of knowledge to the responsibilities of the central state. That is to say, I think, says Francis, that managing knowledge production should be a portfolio, and I'm just the boy to do it for you, dear uncle. And that's really the way I interpret that remark.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. My name is Paul Kennedy. Tonight's program is the first of two about the life and work of the great Elizabethan Englishman, Francis Bacon.
The world must not be narrowed till it will go into our understanding, which has been done hitherto, but our understanding must be expanded and opened until it can take in the image of the world. It is not the pleasure of curiosity, nor the raising of the spirit, nor victory of wit, nor ambition of honor or fame, nor enablement of business that are the true ends of knowledge. Rather, it is a restitution and reinvesting of man to the sovereignty and power which he had in the first state of creation.
There were times throughout his 20s and 30s when Francis Bacon felt just about as far from sovereignty and power as any person could possibly be. He was broke. In fact, meticulous records indicate both that he was deeply in debt and probably could have earned his living as an accountant. Bacon's prospects weren't improved by his growing friendship with Robert Devereux, better known as the Earl of Essex. Francis had been introduced to Essex by his own brother, Anthony Bacon. Anthony was an inner member of the Essex Circle. Young Essex was also the old Queen's favorite. When things went well between the Queen and her courtier, both Bacons could enjoy frequent festivities in the royal palace. When the Queen and Essex quarreled, as they often did, it was best to stay away. Far away. Far outside any possibility that a favorable royal glance might clear the way for some sort of appointment or promotion.
Bacon was thwarted in his ambitions because, as everyone told him at the time, those ambitions were completely out of proportion with what he could expect to have. When he tries to get a first legal position, and Essex roots for him and pushes his case to the Queen, he tries to become Attorney General, which is a ridiculous ambition for a man of his age. The man who got the job was 20 years older. And I think there's a danger from reading Bacon's own letters into assuming that he had a right to all these posts that he thought he should have. But in fact, it would have been very peculiar for someone of his age and lack of legal experience to be given those sort of places. Having said that, it did take him a long, long time to get where he did, and I think that was mainly due to the lack of support from his cousin, Sir Robert Cecil, who became the Earl of Salisbury and became Secretary of State and then Lord Treasurer. And Francis assumed that he would be able to call on Cecil, and it seems that behind the scenes Cecil was in fact thwarting him on each occasion and putting his own candidates in place. So I think it's a combination of an unrealistic ambition, but also a very unhelpful cousin.
And an enormous amount of political bad luck, because when Bacon made the decision to jump ship and denounce Essex, after Essex was dead. What he didn't know was that James was going to favour all those who had stuck with Essex's cause. So there was just a sort of window in which, if, as Bacon did, you almost made it with the ageing Elizabeth, you were then done for with James. Now, it's easy for us to see that, but it wasn't easy for them. And indeed, it's one of, I think, more than one way in which our knowledge of what came afterwards makes Bacon's actions look less sensible than they were at the time. That's one of them. The other thing that is very difficult with hindsight is the Cecils, who did rise and sort of ride the wave from Elizabeth's reign into James's, also developed the civil service and the records that we have now, so that all our sense of that period of history is derived from the archive built by Bacon's opponents. So when Bacon looks as if he's at odds with the obvious direction he should have taken, that's because all the documents that applied to his, what he saw as the way ahead, have been destroyed or lost or dispersed. So what we're seeing with Bacon is a man who took the wrong turning, but that is not willfully or foolishly. It's because at that point the political road bifurcated and he was on the wrong strand.
The winning of honour is but the revealing of a man's virtue and worth without disadvantage. For some in their actions do woo and affect honour and reputation, which sort of men are commonly much talked of, but inwardly little admired. And some, contrariwise, darken their virtue in the show of it, so as they may be undervalued in opinion. If a man perform that which hath not been attempted before, or attempted and given over, or has been achieved, but not with so good circumstance, he shall purchase more honour than by effecting a matter of greater difficulty or virtue, wherein he is but a follower. If a man so temper his actions, as in some one of them he doth content every faction or combination of people, the music will be the fuller. A man is an ill husband of his honour that entereth into any action, the failing wherein may disgrace him more than the carrying of it through can honour him. Honour that is gained and broken upon another hath the quickest reflection, like diamonds cut with facets. And therefore, let a man contend to excel any competitors of his in honour, in outshooting them, if he can, in their own bow.
Games of what if are splendid, and historians play them all the time, sort of running the tape from many different angles as part of the challenge and the creative joy of the trade. And certainly Sir Nicholas, Francis's dad, had lived longer, his younger son would have been less worried about his own financing, and certainly much less anxious about the kind of friends that he needed to keep in order to eventually achieve positions in the government and at the royal court. And yet I suspect that given the sorts of things that young Francis writes during the 1580s, when he's in his early 20s, that he would have endeavored to involve himself in domestic and foreign policy issues. His father, of course, was very, very concerned with domestic policy, not merely with respect to the law, but with respect to the economy. And I think his youngest son showed similar interests and aptitudes. His need to associate with first one faction and then with the other would have been much different, I'm sure, if he had been truly an independent gentleman. But it is, as I was saying before, precisely the point that he was not an independent gentleman, but emotionally as well as through necessity attached to the service of the state that conditions much of his aspiration. But at core, I think he must have had these thoughts and aspirations to begin with. He is born to a family of state centralizers, and I'm sure that he would have maintained that view of what was proper, even if his own material conditions had been otherwise than they were.
The kind of natural philosophical dominion over nature that he has in mind is very much on a par with territorial conquest, which of course is very much an issue in Elizabethan and the Stuart England. And he is very keen to make natural philosophy part of a state enterprise, and he thinks this is, if you like, a way of increasing the productivity or the yield of the national product. There were other connections there between territorial conquest and natural philosophy, and one is the magnetic compass needle. You can't find your way around the Americas and the like without a magnetic compass needle. And this is very much a natural philosophical discovery, but it's been discovered by accident. Bacon is very strongly of the view that if you organize natural philosophy properly, there'll be many other discoveries of this magnitude. And if you think of the changes that have been brought about by the discovery of printing, the discovery of gunpowder, and the discovery of the magnetic compass needle, just think of the range of changes that would be possible if natural philosophy was conducted in a systematic and methodical way, so that these things weren't just hit upon by accident, but were part of a properly regulated program. But he does use this model of territorial conquest in his discussions of natural philosophy. It is a question of going beyond boundaries, going beyond borders, discovering new realms, whether they're intellectual realms or whether they're the Americas. And he does draw, as indeed in that in Elizabethan culture many did, draw lots of parallels between the new explorations and conquests and what's possible in other realms.
More and more, it seemed less and less was possible for Francis Bacon. Every application for advancement or promotion was rejected. He sank still deeper into debt. One night, while leaving the Tower of London, where he'd been cross-examining someone suspected of a plot to murder Queen Elizabeth, Francis Bacon was arrested for debt. This first happened in September of 1598. It would happen again.
One has to distinguish between not having money, which was pretty prevalent amongst the aristocracy. You had a lot of land, but inconveniently little money. You have to distinguish between that general condition and the fact that if you were, let's say, a duke, nobody ever asked you for cash. Your word was enough. A bit of paper was enough. You could transact your whole life without access to money. The problem was, again, if you fell short of that, if you didn't look as if you had the credit rating in your family, if you had three brothers above you with large stately homes to run, it didn't look as if your paper was necessarily going to be worth much. And that's the Bacon problem. He always had a reputation for liking to spend a lot on his clothes and his food and his lifestyle. And that gets caught up with his aspiration to rise in the law. Again, you need to listen to that and realize that that's the rhetoric of talking about upstarts. He isn't an upstart, but on the whole, the people who get accused of dressing above their station or aspiring to a rank or a qualification above their own too early are people who rise literally through the ranks, who are just country gentlemen who rise. Bacon ought to be immune to that sort of criticism, but he's not. And again, that takes us back to being the last son of a noble family whose father died before he could settle him properly. A precariousness. It's a slippery rise for Bacon, and it ought not to be, and it colours his life.
other than love, there can be none of the affections which fascinate or bewitch so much as envy. Both love and envy have vehement wishes. They frame themselves readily into imaginations and suggestions, and they come easily into the eye, especially upon the presence of the objects which are the points that conduce to fascination, if any such thing there be. We see likewise that Scripture calleth envy an evil eye, so that there seemeth to be acknowledged in the act of envy an ejaculation or irradiation of the eye. Nay, some have been so curious as to note that the times when the stroke or percussion of an envious eye doth most hurt are when the party envied is beheld in glory or triumph, for that sets an edge upon envy. And besides, at such times the spirit of the person envied do come forth most into the outward parts, and so meet the blow.
Reading Francis Bacon's prose is both a joy and a frustration, and it may very well have been that way in the 17th and 18th centuries as well as it is today. It's a joy because he is such a master of the writing of sentences, and they fall trippingly from the tongue. And yet it is a frustration in that so many of them are so tightly compressed, little jewels, little miniatures, that it takes a very long time to unpack them and tease the meaning out from the words. Again, characteristically, in an early piece on jurisprudence, he tells us exactly why aphorisms are a good thing. Aphorisms are the pithy packaging of deep wisdom. He sees them as the consequence of a very long process of analysis, of sifting, of rebuilding, of truths, of experience. And so he is happy to cast remarks in the form of an aphorism, precisely because it forces the reader to toss and turn, as he says, and to be creative with it, to unpack it, to wrestle with it, to engage with it in order to extract the full pith. He sees this as a necessary part of the process of becoming learned and wise. And so it is deliberate choice on his part when you find yourself reading sentences and stumble across one of these great nuggets in the road. This is done purposefully in the hope that you will chew upon it for a very long time. It's difficult for those of us who expect our prose writers to be smooth, but there was great pedagogical purpose in filling paragraphs with little aphoristic boulders.
One of the problems with Bacon is that he lived through a very bumpy political period, and his friends of his youth were unmentionable in his maturity, and particularly around the figure of the Earl of Essex, so that he regularly rewrote the story of what his relationship with them had been and distanced it, so that our sense that he and Anthony, his brother, really were very close to the circle of the Earl of Essex, and that that was a kind of dazzling, hypnotizing circle in which, you know, absolute devotion of the kind people talk about to the Princess of Wales, a kind of absolute devotion to the man you serve, which might have showed the young Bacon as a more attractive character, just because that dazzle showed us him being formed by Essex's circle. He erases all of that when he rewrites those documents after Essex has been put to death. You couldn't afford to say that that had been the case, and therefore we can't any longer trace it. So it would involve surmise. I'm interested myself in the way in which when I talk verbally about Bacon, I can be more committed, or I think, to what he might have been than you can when you try to put him on paper. Because as a scrupulous historian, you can only put on paper what you can find, and you can't find enough about the key moments in his life. I don't believe we can find a single piece of surviving evidence to tell us of an intense relationship with anyone except his mother.
There is a closeness in his relationship with Anthony. It's not necessarily in the letters as a particularly emotional relationship, but then it doesn't need to be. I get the impression that they were close enough that most things could go unspoken. Their kind of closeness was one of a practical closeness as well as a brotherly emotional affect. And so they are almost interchangeable. There's one very peculiar moment when the Earl of Essex is out of favour with Elizabeth, and Francis decides that he will write letters, one of them from his brother Anthony to the Earl of Essex, and one from Essex back to Anthony Bacon. And this seems to him perfectly reasonable thing to do, that he will write as Anthony to Essex and then show these letters to the Queen to show what kind of state of mind Essex is in. But he, of course, at the same time as he does that, he uses the occasion to write about himself. So Anthony says, "You really must pay more attention to my brother, Mr. Francis Bacon, because he's a wonderful man." And Essex writes back, "Yes, I know he's a wonderful man." And then Francis shows these letters to the Queen. And that sort of taking advantage of a very close brotherly relationship is something which we might find strange and callous. I don't think he did at all. I think he thought it was part of what their relationship should be about, which was a mutual self-help. Anthony was bedridden by this point. He wasn't going to go anywhere politically, but the least Anthony could do was to make sure that Francis went somewhere.
Among the principal fruits of friendship is one which is like the pomegranate, full of many kernels. I mean, aid and bearing a part in all actions and occasions. How many things there are which a man cannot do himself? The ancients said that a friend, in fact, is another self, or that a friend is far more than himself. Men have their time and die many times in desire of some things which they principally take to heart, the bestowing of a child, the finishing of a work, or the like. If a man have a true friend, he may rest almost secure that the care of those things will continue after him, so that a man hath, as it were, two lives in his desires. A man hath a body, and the body is confined to a place, but where friendship is, all offices of life are, as it were, granted to him and to his deputy, for he may exercise them by his friend. How many things are there which a man cannot, with any face or comeliness, say or do himself? A man can scarce allege his own merits with modesty, much less extol them. A man cannot sometimes brook to supplicate or beg, and a number of the like. But all these things are graceful in a friend's mouth, which are blushing in a man's own. But to enumerate these things were endless. I have given the rule. Where a man cannot fitly play his own part, if he have not a friend, he may quit the stage.
As well as sitting in his apartments and reading his law books and going to court and doing whatever he could to be noticed by the great lords and the queen, Francis Bacon was also prepared and indeed wrote several court masks. And what I think is significant about these dramas is less their dramatic content, which personally I think are rather dreary, but natural philosophy that appears in the most unexpected in a court drama, to have one of your major speakers suddenly begin to discourse on the public value, that is to say the political value, of investigating natural philosophy. It's characteristic, I think, of Francis Bacon that he will seize a venue and turn a well-known trope to a new purpose. So even in things that don't appear to us to have anything to do with the natural sciences, we find Bacon speaking of these topics and speaking of them precisely to the audience that mattered, the people that could potentially say yes, and in particular, the Queen herself.
Queen Elizabeth never did find it in her heart to fully say yes to Francis Bacon. His application for the relatively junior position of Solicitor General was permanently backburnered when Bacon alienated his sovereign by speaking eloquently against a tax bill from his new place in Parliament. "We are here to search the wounds of the realm and not to skin them over," proclaimed the new member for Middlesex. Add orator to his lengthening list of accomplishments. The Queen was not amused. Francis Bacon's long-awaited, much-deserved progression through the corridors of power would now be postponed until her death. We'll hear the story of his glory years, followed by his mighty fall, in part two of Francis Bacon. On Ideas Tonight, the first program in a two-part series on Francis Bacon. Selections from Francis Bacon's famous essays, first published in 1597, were read by Juan Kioran. Francis Bacon was produced by me, Paul Kennedy, with the help of Dave Field. The executive producer of Ideas is Richard Handler. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 for the hourly news, followed by The Arts Today and Between the Covers.
You're listening to CBC Radio 1, News and More.